Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Russell M. Nelson, president of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, dies. Speaking in Charlie Kirk's place, Governor Spencer Cox is booed at USU ahead of urging peacemaking. And a prominent Utah LGBTQ plus organization sees an exodus of therapists. Later in the program, we'll be talking with culture and music reporter Palak Jaiswal and senior religion reporter Peggy Fletcher Stack. Right now, we bring in Salt Lake Tribune State Watch reporter Emily Anderson Stern. Emily, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Appreciate it. Your story this week talked about a Turning Point USA event in Logan on the campus of Utah State University. Very poignant, because this was to have been headlined by Charlie Kirk, who, of course, was murdered in Orem several weeks earlier. First of all, maybe just to set the scene there, this Turning Point USA, who was there, I guess, who was headlining in place of Charlie Kirk?
Right. So, you know, just to go back a bit, after Charlie Kirk was killed, his wife, Erica Kirk, she has since taken over the organization he co-founded, Turning Point USA. And she had said, you know, this tour will continue. And they've booked other conservative activists and commentators at places across the country, and Republican politicians. And here in Utah, they had scheduled a four-person panel. And that was supposed to include Governor Spencer Cox, Senator Mike Lee, former Representative Jason Chaffetz, who's now a commentator on Fox News, and Arizona Congressman Andy Biggs. Senator Mike Lee ended up not being able to make it because of votes around the government shutdown, government funding. So he stayed in Washington and pre-recorded a video.
So I guess the top line here, Governor Cox was booed. I guess this was ahead of his appearance on that panel.
Yeah, he was. And it's not the first time the governor has been booed. He's often booed when he goes to when he speaks at the Utah Republican Party's conventions. Many of the delegates in the Utah Republican Party are to the right of him. And Turning Point USA is similar. A lot of folks in that organization or who agree with the messages that it puts out tend to fall to the right of Governor Cox, or at least to the right of Governor Cox and the policies that he has endorsed in the past. But, you know, as he began speaking to this crowd, as he was asked to start sharing his experience on the day that Charlie Kirk was killed, the crowd initially would not let him get a word in. They were booing. There were some folks yelling and telling him to shut up. And, you know, the host leading the panel, his name's Tyler Boyer. He's a Latter-day Saint. So he has Utah connections. He's been one of the leaders of Turning Point Action, which is the political campaign arm of Turning Point USA. But he told the crowd essentially to calm down and to do what he said Charlie Kirk would have done, which is listen to the governor and what he has to say and then respond.
The governor said that he, trying to remember his quote, he said he and Charlie Kirk would agree on about 99% of things.
Yeah, and you could tell as the governor was speaking to this crowd, it was a little bit different than some of the things he was saying, say, a couple of days earlier on 60 Minutes, or that he would say maybe in front of a crowd where the political leanings weren't so obvious. And, you know, he was talking about how, you know, he's gotten a lot of hate from this crowd for a decision in 2022 to veto a bill that would have banned transgender girls from playing high school sports on teams that align with their gender identity. You know, for folks who followed that story, the supermajority Republican Utah legislature eventually overrode that veto. Now there's an adjusted law in place which is being challenged in court. So that's a little bit of a moving policy. But since then, he's signed a few other bills that have placed restrictions on transgender Utahns. And really, as far as where he was someone who was known as a Republican who was vocal about wanting to support the LGBTQ plus community, he's kind of backed away from some of his gestures of support that he's made in the past. So I think, as he was saying that, he has said that he wished he had the opportunity to talk to Charlie Kirk now. Charlie Kirk, when he vetoed that bill in 2022, had actually tweeted that he thought that the governor should be expelled from the Republican Party. But Governor Cox said he wished he could talk to Charlie Kirk, and he feels like they would have different feelings about each other now and that they would agree on most things.
Well, the thing that jumped out at me it among a lot of remarks from the governor and others, of course, we're talking about that as well. The governor seemed to blame one side, seemed to blame the left for inflaming rhetoric.
Right. And he said that he, sees a lot of this political violence being caused by one main thing, and that's when people perceive speech as being violent. And so, he said that that comes from the left, right? When people on the left will call out prejudicial remarks and say that they're harmful, say, that they lead to policies that harm communities, and portray that as violence. He says that that will lead to people seeing violence itself as speech. So for example, seeing the killing of Charlie Kirk is justified because they see it as a form of speech. And he said that he only sees that coming from the left side of the political spectrum. And throughout the night, that was kind of the theme from him. It was sounding like, he sees mostly a lot of political violence coming from the left. There was one point later in the night where he briefly acknowledged that on the far right, there are times that there's political violence, and he said he'd be lying to say there wasn't. But mostly, the sentiment was that a lot of the political violence that's emerged in recent months has come from rhetoric on the left.
So what did the other speakers say in general?
A lot of them, as I had pointed out earlier, where Turning Point USA, a lot of its members generally fall to the right of Governor Cox. That was similar with the other panelists. And so, a lot of it was agreeing with each other. Yes, saying things about the left. Former Representative Chaffetz, he's actually a speculated candidate for governor in 2028, when Governor Cox has said he plans to leave the position. He only plans to serve 2 terms. And he also, essentially voiced his support for restrictions on the transgender community, and said that he feels that the culture in the United States has moved to be a little bit too tolerant from his perspective.
What were people in the crowd saying? You have a side story with some photographs of shirts. By the way, there's several shirts and comments critical of Governor Cox, but maybe we could start there.
Yeah, and I. Before Governor Cox was booed walking in, I wondered if that was a possibility. Like I mentioned, I've been at other events where he's been booed by conservatives, folks who are in the same party as him. And as I was walking in, you could see supporters of his Republican challenger from last year, Phil Lyman, a former state lawmaker. And some of them were holding up posters with screenshots of the social media posts Charlie Kirk had made that were critical of Governor Cox, and wearing t-shirts of it. And asking, people who passed by, like, do you know about Governor Cox? And telling them, that person, how they feel about him. One of those individuals told us that they thought that the governor was grandstanding, quote, grandstanding on Charlie Kirk's assassination. And then, you saw a lot of the political attire that you would expect to see among folks who lean to the right in the US. Saw a lot of Make America Great Again hats and shirts. And there were also a lot of Turning Point USA shirts. And many of those were shirts that were white and said freedom in all caps on the front, which was identical to the shirt that Charlie Kirk was wearing when he was killed.
Were there any on the left, any of that side of the political spectrum?
There were not any that I really observed, besides maybe some students who walked past the line of folks who were waiting to get in. But it was a ticketed event. There were warnings to those who went not to disturb it, not to have any disturbances. People couldn't bring in like posters and items like that if they were going to protest or voice their opposition. But ahead of the event, there were some Utah State students critical of it and speaking out against it. And, it wasn't all for the opposition to it on Utah State's campus wasn't entirely just based on politics. After what happened at Utah Valley University, there were students who were saying that they felt unsafe, to have that event continue on their campus.
This is something I learned from this series of stories. There was at least one gentleman carrying the old Utah State flag. Apparently, this has become a symbol for what, Lyman supporters, people on the far right.
Yeah, and I think that was the flag that they brought into the event, but he ran by carrying it past the line and everyone just started cheering. And there were some comments actually made. There were questions asked and things brought up during the panel about the flag. Yeah, it's the historical state flag. It'll be used in ceremonies. But there has been an opposition to embracing the new state flag, which came from an effort pushed by, frankly, one of the most conservative senators in the legislature. But yeah, it's become almost a symbol or a rallying cry for folks who feel like they who fall probably to the right of many elected Republicans in the state, and they see it as kind of a cancel culture type of thing to be have gotten rid of the old flag and put in place a new one. But frankly, the politicians who supported it, the lawmakers who voted for it, have said more that they see Utah's old flag as outdated and boring, not so much of a there aren't so much of cultural critiques in their purpose for replacing the flag.
I imagine security was high alert, a lot of security. What was tell me about that.
Yeah, the security was much tighter than at Utah when I was at Utah Valley University for the Charlie Kirk event. There were, a handful of campus police officers, not much else. No one was ticketed, no one's bags were checked. Here it was much different. This event, the last event was outdoors, and that was at the request of Charlie Kirk. That's kind of the style that he likes, so that anyone on campus can hear what's happening or might pass by and hear it. This was moved to the basketball arena at Utah State University. It was ticketed. Everyone had to have a ticket that they scanned to get in. And there were dogs that were sniffing for bombs among everyone that was entering. And your bags were checked by security. But it was an effort. There was a lot more of a law enforcement presence on that campus. You could see there were federal law enforcement, there was local and state law enforcement. And of course, the campus law enforcement and security. So it was a pretty big lift for them to work to make sure this event did not turn out like the last one in Utah.
Well, we've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune State Watch reporter Emily Anderson Stern. Thanks for telling us about this.
Thanks for talking, Tom.
Thank you. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking about the death of Russell M. Nelson, president of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We'll look at his time as president, a little bit of his biography as well, with senior religion reporter Peggy Fletcher Stack. You are listening to Behind the Headlines, weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Hope you'll stay with us following the break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. And here's the headline we're going to talk about in this segment of the program. Russell M. Nelson, Latter-day Saint prophet of change and pandemic, dies. And we welcome in senior religion reporter Peggy Fletcher Stack. Thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
So President Nelson died, I believe, late Saturday night, right?
Yep, 10 p.m. Saturday night.
101 years old, which obviously makes him the oldest Latter-day Saint leader, I believe.
Yep, definitely the oldest. I think the next nearest was Gordon Hinckley. I think he was 97, I want to say.
Yeah, but President Nelson was the second oldest to assume the presidency, I believe.
Yeah, he was 93 when he took the reins. That is the second oldest. I'm blanking on who the oldest. It might have been Joseph Fielding Smith. Not
Yeah,
sure.
yeah. So obviously we've known him as dynamic, you know, despite his age. Tell me a few of the things that he did. Some of the highlights, the milestones.
Sure. I mean, it's so interesting. Like, a 93-year-old, everybody thought when he became the president in t January 2018 that he would be kind of a caretaker president. He would be too old to really do anything. And he took off with a run at the beginning. The first thing he did was get on an airplane and jet around the world. He did a kind of a world tour visiting members and all kinds of several continents. And then he started changing things, introducing changes too. The church is more than 200 years old, and no, not quite. Anyway, it's he's he first thing he, one of the things he did was reverse the controversial LGBTQ plus policy, which barred labeled some same-sex member couples as apostates and barred their minor children from religious rights. That policy was vigorously opposed, and during his tenure, the church reversed it. At the same time, and it also endorsed the Federal Respect for Marriage Act, which codified same-sex marriage, but with a caveat to protect religious freedoms. Made a lot of changes to temple ceremonies, adapting more inclusive language. So men and women, once men promised to obey God as women obeyed their husbands, that was changed to both groups both genders obeying God. A big thing Russell Nelson did was tell members and outsiders not to use the nickname Mormon to refer to the church members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, but to, use Latter-day Saints and as often as possible use the full name of the church. It's caused some ripples in some quarters. A big thing that I think was quite historic was he called three new apostles. The church is led by a three-person first presidency and then a quorum of 12 apostles. And among those new apostles, he called Garrett Gong, the first Asian American, Ulysses Soares of Brazil, and Patrick Heron of Great Britain. These were, the first non-Americans or men of color in the quorum. So, well, Patrick Heron's not a man of color, but he's from Great Britain. Anyway, also had the iconic Salt Lake Temple closed for a massive renovation and retrofitting, especially since making it earthquake proof. But at the same time, he gutted that temple, which has caused a lot of ripples among historians and preservationists, and also that ended the use of live temple rituals. I'll just give you a few highlights. There's more.
Yes, a lot, right? In those almost
Yeah.
eight years, yeah. He definitely announced and had built, I don't know how many temples, many, many temples.
Many, many temples. I think that my colleague, my editor, actually, Dave Noyce, has kept track of how many temples. It's the most of any church president. Let's see, an unprecedented pace of temple building, announcing 200 new edifices, accounting for more than half of the faith's 382 existing or planned temples. Temple building was definitely a Russell Nelson concern and love. He really wanted to make sure that members around the globe had access to a temple, which is, I mean, he's gonna stepped up the pace of temple building.
A sub-headline here, A Man of Science and a Man of God. Of course, President Hinckley, or President Nelson, heart surgeon, famous heart surgeon, right? Accomplished.
Yes, very famous.
And then COVID happened on his watch. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, 2 years after he became president, the global pandemic of COVID-19 hit everywhere, and the church had to shut down its weekly meetings and its temples. And as soon as it was obviously, for those who remember, it was a very, very big deal. And he then, as a doctor again, he urged everyone to get vaccinated and wear masks, and had photos of himself being vaccinated and wearing a mask, and sent a big message to the world that, this is a good thing to do.
A lot of other changes in the church. 3-hour church reduced to two,
Yep.
and many other changes with the way the Latter-day Saints worship.
He did that, yes. In addition to the temple, changing the temple ceremonies, he was responsible for moving the 3 hour block to 2 hours. He changed sort of the language of the For Strength of Youth pamphlet, which talks about this modesty standards and that sort of thing for young people, encouraging them to use principles rather than a checklist. He changed the what was known as the visiting teaching and home teaching, where members would visit one another once a month, to something called ministering. He merged a couple of priesthood quorums. all of that, that was kind of internal things he did, as well as, well, one big thing he did was, the church bought its first temple in Kirtland, Ohio, which was a big purchase from it's from the Community of Christ, which was formerly the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, also announced the building of a medical school at Brigham Young University. And one of my favorite things, he offered that the church began to offer sleeveless temple garments.
That's right. Yeah.
It got a lot of interest among members.
President Nelson would reached across potential racial divides as well. That was a push of his.
It was a big push of his. The church had a long-standing exclusion of black men from the priesthood and black men and women from its temple rituals. That ended in 1978, but there's still been lingering racism among members or perception. And President Nelson reached out to leaders of the NAACP and met with them, began to have a collaboration, and really urged members to not be racist and to love and connect with people of other races and faiths. It was a very visible change.
Let's maybe treat a couple of things from his biography. It's 101 years. We'd be talking for several hours to get the whole thing in. But so he married his first wife, Dan Soll, or they had nine daughters and one son.
It's only true.
Dan Soll died. And then he the year following, he was an apostle at this point. Married Wendy Watson, who was quite prominent in her own right at that point.
Right, I think she was a therapist, I think. Anyway, yeah, she's been by his side this whole time of his presidency. As
1984 was when he and Dallin Oaks were called as apostles. There was some controversy. Why are you taking a surgeon and a prominent lawyer, out of secular world? Now, 40 some odd years later, we see the kind of the results of that. Anything else you'd like to say about President Nelson's presidency? That any of the changes? I guess maybe just a word on legacy. What do we think would be the top points of legacy from President Nelson?
I think most people will see his legacy as largely being about the temple building project and really celebrating the church as a global faith. I think that began with other presidents, but President Nelson really, with his first trip and then the temple building, I would argue that I would say that globalization, internationalization, and the temple building are probably his biggest legacies. But some of these other things we've talked about as well, the more gender equity in temple ceremonies, and his certainly the weekly changes in services. I think those are the things that for which he will be most remembered, and probably the trying to get rid of the word Mormon in common parlance.
There's one more thing I maybe want to bring out here that you've included in your stories here. Several people have remarked that President Nelson used the word revelation maybe a bit more than his predecessors. He was I want to be very clear. This is revelation from God.
Yeah, that's true. He really did. He used the term revelation to underscore the importance of these changes much more than previous presidents had. I think to really tell members, these aren't just my ideas or good ideas. These really are important changes. They come from God through me, through him, obviously. And it was definitely an emphasis of his. At the same time, he really encouraged members to seek revelation on their own, to seek divine input into their choices, into their daily lives, into their relationships. It was very much a focus of his.
So in the meantime, there was a tribute yesterday, right? A viewing Monday, funeral on Tuesday, I believe. In the middle there's General Conference. This is somewhat unusual, the president dying about a week before General Conference.
This is very unusual. I guess there, anyway, it's very rare. And I wrote a story of the fact that it created a conflict for the presumed successor, who was Dallin Oaks, who was put into the Quorum of 12 Apostles on the same day. He was called to the Quorum of the 12 Days, Quorum of the 12 Apostles on the same day as Russell Nelson. And now he's the presumed leader. But after a president dies, the tradition has been that the three-man presidency is dissolved, and it's not reconstituted until after the funeral of the predecessor. In this case, and then usually, announced, endorsed, whatever, and sustained at the next general conference. In this case, it happened too fast. And so the future President Oaks had to choose between, do I wait till after the funeral, or do we have a general conference without a reconstituted first presidency? And he couldn't do both of those things. It's not clear which of those precedents he will break, but I'll have to wait and see. General conference is this weekend. If there's an
This
announcement
weekend.
tomorrow or something,
Right, well, no. In the meantime, you had a couple of stories speculating, of course, that's what a lot of people are doing. So here's the headline in one story. You just talked about when might Dallin Oaks officially become the next president. The next headline, whom might he pick for his counselors? What are some people saying?
Well, one of the issues is the current. So his after President Nelson died, the other man in the presidency is Henry B. Eyring, and Henry Eyring is also in his 90s, not in terrific health, a little frail. And then the next person in line after o President Oaks is Jeffrey Holland, who has suffered several serious health crises, was some kidney disease, kidney dialysis. So, do they need a younger man in the presidency? In the presidency, it does not have to be by seniority. It can a president can choose anyone he wants in the presidency. Typically, they have been apostles, but not always next in line. So speculation is, should he put Jeffrey Holland in the presidency with President Eyring? But that would make a threesome that were not all that healthy. Do they need someone who can travel? So should they pick a Dieter Uchtdorf, who is after Eyring? Should they dip down farther and pick David Bednar, or even lower, someone who's in better health? So those are the kinds of speculations people are making. Of course, no one will know until it's announced,
That's
and
right.
it could be. It totally, we could be completely wrong about, all the people who have speculated in my stories. And I will say, I don't have a good track record.
I see. I see. Yeah. And we don't know, right? Finally, you had a story you reached out to several people to speculate who Dallin Oaks might select as the next apostle. What I guess there was several people were saying that they might follow President Nelson, pick somebody diverse. But again, we don't know. Who are some names being floated?
Well, it does seem like the two places that are typically the pool, or in the last years have been the pool for the new apostles, have been a quorum called the Seven Presidents of 70. And the top of that is, again, a man named Carl Cook. He spoke at the tribute to President Nelson yesterday. And then the other quorum that often has people have been plucked into the to made an apostle is the presiding bishop, who oversees the church's financial holdings, their land, the buildings, the temples. And currently that person is Gerald Cosset, who's French. I'm not saying his name right. He might be a really good candidate. But again, they don't have to pick from either of those quorums. There's some, you know, obviously neither President Nelson nor President Oaks were apostles at the time. I mean, they were apostles when they became president, but they were not in either of those quorums when they became apostles, is what I'm trying to say. So, and David Bednar was also picked. He was the president of BYU-Idaho. So Jeffrey Holland, you know, those are interesting choices. Well, so that's the part where speculation is fun, because it's not just automatic.
Right. Yeah. And we'll find out soon enough. Well, we've been talking in this part of the program with Salt Lake Tribune senior religion reporter Peggy Fletcher Stack. And following a break, we'll continue with Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll be talking with culture and music reporter Palak Jaiswal, here's the headline: a prominent Utah LGBTQ plus organization sees an exodus of therapists. Peggy Fletcher Stack, thank you so much for taking the time.
Always a pleasure.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Here's the headline we're going to talk about in this segment. A prominent Utah LGBTQ plus organization sees an exodus of therapists. We're going to bring in Salt Lake Tribune culture and music reporter Palak Jaiswal. Palak, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Appreciate you taking the time. So we're talking about which organization?
We are talking about Inner Circle. Is an organization founded in 2016 to support Utah's LGBTQ youths and their family. They do this by providing resources, and they have these safe spaces to gather in a variety of Utah cities. They're called Homes, and they have one in Provo, Salt Lake, St. George, Heber, and now Ogden.
So Inner Circle. So they have these homes, I guess, safe places. They also provide therapists?
Yes. So one of the kind of resources that I mentioned earlier that Inner Circle has been providing is therapy for youth and sometimes their families, I think. And what happened here in this case is around mid-March, it lasted around 10 weeks. Seven of Inner Circle's nine therapists across the houses, left the organization, either by way of layoffs or by resignation. Now, currently, Inner Circle has of those original therapists that remain with the organization, but they've also since hired some new interns and other kind of therapist specialists. And so now they have seven, but it was almost a near turnover of the entire department. And kind of what prompted this turnover is Inner Circle changed how the clinicians' workload was handled.
Yeah, so how so? Tell me about that.
Yes, so Inner Circle told me, you know, over the past couple of years, they have been looking at how they run their therapy program internally. Now, this, included a whole look at, their billing agency, how they run the therapy department and stuff like that. And part of this kind of internal look at the department was asking clinicians to get to a certain number of cases per week. In this case, they asked the team to get to 25 cases per week, per therapist. And a lot of these therapists who have left, I talked to three of them for this story. They told me that they felt like that was an unattainable workload and that they couldn't do it. And so they decided to leave, but they were laid off. And when I talked to Encircle about, how did they reach this industry standard of 25 cases, they told me that they kind of looked at different organizations of their size in the area and determined it based off that. And essentially, the kind of tension point here is that if these therapists weren't able to meet that 25 caseload per week, they would be transferred to a hourly wage, meaning they would lose their healthcare benefits and other benefits that come with a salaried position.
So, seven of them, I guess, have left. Is that the case? They've and Encircle has hired five, so a net loss of two.
Yes, so there was seven people who either left or were laid off. And then originally, we should say that there was nine therapists total. Two of them remain with Encircle. Seven have either resigned or been laid off by Encircle. And since they have, hired some new interns and other clinicians, and so now they're currently at seven. But while this transition was happening, a lot of these young clients, were kind of left in the middle of this tension between the workload and the therapist and Encircle. Encircle didn't give me an exact number of how many clients would have been affected by this. They did say that, all the clients were either transferred to a new therapist or they followed their therapist who left Encircle. So it's a kind of a industry tension point, but some of these young individuals were caught in the middle.
This is a particularly vulnerable group, right? LGBTQ plus youth. Tell me, you had some statistics from the Trevor Project in your story. Tell me about this.
The Trevor Project does an annual kind of mental health look at each of the 50 states for LGBTQ youth. And so their 2024 report for Utah found that 47% of young Utahns wanted access to mental health care in 2024, but did not receive it, for a variety of reasons, such as cost, parental permission, or even fear about speaking about their concerns or their identities. And so, the need for these services has been demonstrated not only in the Trevor Project survey, but I also talked to another therapist in Utah. Her name is C. Meyer. She primarily works with LGBTQ youth, and C works with Flourish Therapy. And C told me a little bit about how destabilizing, some of these changes can be, particularly for young clients, since they have, quote, a really hard time trusting people. So this is, it's a interesting kind of tension point between these therapists and Encircle, who at the end of the day, want to serve clients, but weren't able to because of this new introduction of this workload standard.
So do we presumably Encircle feels like they're on a better financial footing with the new program going forward?
They didn't explicitly say that to me, but Callie Birdsall Chambers, who I spoke to that represented Encircle in the story, she said that these changes were made to provide stabilization for the organization and to make sure they're sustainable financially. Now, I don't know if those changes have happened yet, but that was kind of their thinking behind doing this.
So that the survey from the Trevor Project that you cited, it's several reasons why young people maybe don't get the therapy. I guess cost would be one of the factors, and there would be others.
Yes, and I think generally when we look at the state of Utah's mental health services for LGBTQ youth in particular, there are only a handful of places that are available for young people. And Circle is one of them. Another example is Flourish Therapy. You know, in the past, unrelated to this particular story, I have done stories on how therapists are dealing with helping these young people in our state.
I don't know, are there sufficient resources for these youth?
You know, that's hard to say. I can't claim that I'm an expert in this field, but I do think what I have heard from therapists is there has been an increase in demand, and that's something that's hard to keep up with.
One person you talked to, an ex-Encircle therapist, said, I'll just quote Sammy Simpson's name, "We certainly witnessed an increase in suicidal ideation across clients who would not be able to continue seeing their therapist." And this is... many of these youth are at special risk, right, here?
Yes. I don't think these particular statistics made the final version of the story, but I linked to the Trevor Project report in my story where people can find these statistics, but 42% of LGBTQ plus young people in Utah seriously considered suicide in the past year. Again, that report was... conducted in 2024. So what Sammy is saying, you know, really applies to this certain situation. I think Sammy is speaking especially on behalf of the patients between these three therapists who have left. But even if you kind of take this particular case with Encircle out, there is a need in this state for mental health services for these youth.
Well, thank you for telling us about this, Palak Jaiswal. We just have a couple of minutes here. You went to FanX, right? Talked to some people.
I did go to FanX.
You wrote a couple, two or three stories on this. Give me 2 minutes on what stood out to you from FanX.
FanX is always so chaotic and so fun to cover. This year, one of the interesting stories that came out of it was the convention took a stand on AI-generated art. They asked everyone who sells goods on their vendor floors to not sell AI-generated art. And so that's kind of a big topic in the fandom world right now about supporting, you know, artists who actually draw the work and don't just put a prompt into an AI generator. So I was able to talk to Tony Santiago, who has been going to FanX for years and years about this, and he hand draws some amazing character art of superheroes and Taylor Swift and Harry Potter. And he talked a little bit about how he felt about a convention taking a stand on that. And the other stories that came out of FanX, I went to a panel led by Brandon Sanderson, a really well-known author in general, but he's also a Utah author who writes sci-fi and fantasy books. And he talked about how he did consider buying what used to be Evermore Park out in Pleasant Grove. I also went to a Lord of the Rings panel where, you know, some of the stars kind of credited the fans for keeping the series alive all these years. And then the last story I did was about a panel where Mei Hong was speaking. Mei Hong is voice of a animated character in a new Netflix film called K-Pop Demon Hunters. That film is Netflix's most watched movie ever. And that was fun. Mei Hong didn't take any questions from the crowd, and she was a couple minutes late to the panel, so they played the soundtrack of this film, and the crowd was just filled with all these young children just screaming their heart out to this viral movie that's going on. So that was what happened at FanX this year.
All right. Well, thanks for telling us about that. We've been talking on this segment of the of Behind the Headlines with Salt Lake Tribune's culture and music reporter Palak Jaiswal. You have been listening to Behind the Headlines, weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Palak, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thank you. And hope you'll join me, Tom Williams, for Behind the Headlines next time.